Initially, landowners have 2 years to bring their property into compliance with the standards, and then once they've met the standards, they're required to self-certify that they've done so. In the end, compliance is voluntary. A landowner doesn't have to do anything, and the landowner does not conduct inspections, nor does it have an enforcement program. However, a failure to apply the standards and then to self-certify does make a landowner automatically liable to the state for the reimbursement of certain fire suppression costs up to a maximum of $100,000. In passing Senate Bill 360, the legislature directed the department to take a slow and thoughtful approach to implementation, and I believe that we did fulfill that charge, and to date the act has been very well received both by property owners and by local governments that we work with. Implementation is taking place county by county on a priority basis based upon the risk of fire and the number of homes which are exposed. In a typical county, implementation takes 3 to 4 years, and we've now fully completed the process in both Deschutes and Jackson counties. Implementation is currently underway in an additional 10 counties, and we've secured funding but not yet started in 8 more counties. As the act has been implemented, we have found some minor changes or adjustments to the original legislation which are needed, and that's the purpose of Senate Bill 99 before you today. And I'll run through a couple of examples, not as many as in my testimony that you have in writing there. One example would be development such as Sun River. Sun River is an example. The Homeowners Association has an aggressive program in place to deal with fire-prone vegetation. One program substantially matches the standards called for under Senate Bill 360. We would like the clear authority to enter into a limited term agreement with the Homeowners Association to accept their standards in lieu of the state coming in and basically brushing those aside and saying they don't count, we're gonna go with our own program. Another example is implementation in a county starts with the formation of a county forest land urban interface classification committee. And the majority of committee members are appointed by the county governing body. There's 5 people on these committees, 3 of which are appointed by the county governing body. Currently, when a person is appointed to a county committee, it's a lifetime appointment. And this has proven to be somewhat intimidating, so we would propose terms of 4 years with any number of terms being possible. Another example, Senate Bill 360 contained an enabling section which was not codified in statute. And contained in that section was the legislature's desire that homeowners be given that 2 years that I talked about in order to initially bring their property into compliance with the standards before they become subject to the potential liability of $100,000. And Section 9 of the bill would place that timeline into the statutes. Concerns also arisen that landowners could be subject to an unfair moving of the goalposts if the standards they are required to meet are modified too frequently. In an advisory committee which was appointed by the Board of Forestry recommended that we seek legislation which would limit an individual property owner having to adjust to revise standards no more frequently than once every 5 years, and hopefully not even that often. But Section 9 would incorporate the advisory committee's recommendation in that regard. The present version of the Act makes the assumption that each piece of property has one owner, and especially in Central Oregon, that is not the case. Property at the end of the Sulphur Mountain is a good example. One parcel may have any number of owners, and it's unclear how the department or how the owners are to then apply the Act's requirements. And so Section 2 contains some language that would allow us to work through such situations. The Act currently contains what amounts to a non-competition clause, and the intent of this clause is to allow local governments, if they so choose, to put into place equal or stronger wildfire mitigation standards, and we agree wholeheartedly with that. But we did have a problem come up in Deschutes County where the Board of Commissioners was considering an ordinance which essentially was exactly like ours, but they wanted to make it apply elsewhere. But the way that was done, there would have been some overlap. And so we told the county, we have no objection to you doing that, but if you do that, we have to back out and not implement in Deschutes County. And so then, as a result of that, they stopped their ordinance process. And Section 2 of the bill before you would allow us to enter into a cooperative agreement with local governments that would allow us the flexibility to adjust to these situations. And Deschutes County is doing that now. They're basically in a waiting mode so that if this passes, then we can join and go together and cover most of the county with some sort of a standard. In summary, Senate Bill 99 would make adjustments to the Oregon Forest Land Urban Interface Fire Protection Act of 1997, and it would improve the implementation process and also enhance the overall effectiveness of the act. The bill addresses issues which have been raised by landowners, by local governments, and by the department. And the department does support the bill. And with that, I thank you for your time and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Rick? Okay. Thank you. Got off easy.
Thank you.
Going to call to. We should probably. I think we're just going to continue going through these, and then we'll see. We'll go back and do 2520 after we get all the way through this process. So Gil from AOC. Oh, great. Well, we added him on too in the end, but if you want to come now, that's fine.
Yeah, no, it's fine. We're both going to be very brief.
We pulled it early because we went out of order, so it's not your fault. It's ours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here delivering a message from the AOC Natural Resources Steering Committee, which is made up largely of rural land commissioners. And what they wanted me to point out was that this program may be the perfect opportunity to for the state to join counties in telling the federal government to clean up its own land, to do what is expected of Oregon landowners. Not only would it reduce wildfire risk, but it would create some economic activity. And that's the extent of the message, but I think it's a serious one. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Gil? I think Representative Maurer's formula, he's getting close.
Well, no, I have a question, but I don't know. Are you suggesting a way to do that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, this is... I am fulfilling a promise to commissioners. They want to make sure that that this committee is aware of the difficulty that it's right now. It's kind of a one-sided deal. You have interface homeowners and budding federal land, and the federal land is the dangerous is the land that's dangerous. And they'd like for you to consider any means to help us get the federal government to do that. Now, we have two members on the Federal Forest Land Advisory Committee, which is advising the Board of Forestry in their formulation of how the state should address federal land planning, and we're taking that message there, too. But I was instructed to come here, so I thought I'd better do it.
Further questions at this point? Oh, yeah, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you opposed or for Senate Bill 99? Do you think
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, they didn't specifically weigh in, although I've been around long enough to remember this in 97 and, in fact, was involved in the development of the original program. And we have counties that are operating successfully under this. Other counties that are going to maybe a little more on the... if there's going to be resistance, it's going to be for the reason that I stated. Let me just put it that way. The reason why this is a slow approach is there are some counties, some residents of counties that expect the deal to be more or less equal between them and the federal government, and they don't see that yet. So, but to this point, no, not weighing in against it.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Great, Ray.
Thank you. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council, and I'm pinch hitting today for Mike Dykesel, who's on our staff that deals with forest protection issues. He had a family emergency, but he had prepared written testimony and asked me to come over here and submit it and just briefly say that we support Senate Bill 99. We were involved with the original bill in 1997. This is an important program, and the issue is getting more acute, not less acute, in terms of the number of people who live in the interface zones and the health of our forests, which is not getting any better in terms of fire risk. So my understanding is the counties where this program is most mature, it has been pretty successful and pretty well accepted by most people now, and hopefully that will continue to grow. But just wanted to get on the record that OFIC supports Senate Bill 99.
Any questions for Representative McPherson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to put this question to both of you gentlemen, and you can feel free to both to respond or to defer to one or the other. My just quick reading of the bill, and this is an issue that I'm sure has a lot more history in it than I'm party to, looks like it requires the residential owner to bear the cost of fire suppression up to $100,000, but only if the fire originates on the owner's land. And one of the issues that I see is that fires that may originate just naturally or from other causes nearby, that a lot of resources get invested in preventing those fires from coming onto the property and destroying the residents where a person has chosen to live in that setting. Am I reading the bill correctly that essentially the cost of fire protection isn't being borne by the property owner? In that case, it's only if the fire originates on their property.
Representative McPherson, I don't know the answer to your question specifically, but the situation that you've just described is an accurate one. Regardless of where the fire starts, if you've got this interface situation, it makes it much more difficult and expensive to fight a fire. So having people, residences in those areas when a fire occurs is a major complication to putting the fire out. I think that's where you were going. I don't know enough about the program to know exactly how the bill structured the department. I think, or maybe Gil knows, or the department would know. But
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I wouldn't be the expert compared to the department, but yes, I think you're reading it right, and the issue that there are counties that have increased the requirements for fire safe areas, if the firefighting resources are devoted to particular tactics, that's over my head. I'm not trained in that area, but I think you read the law correctly. It has to originate on the homeowner's land for them to be liable to $100,000.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you want to have the department take a shot?
I wouldn't mind if it was not inconvenient to have the department come back up.
Do you want to? Okay, is that acceptable?
Okay.
Mr. Vice Chairman, Representative McPherson, people who live on forest.
I'm sorry, one second. Could you just, for the record, again, say your name?
Richard Gibson, Oregon Department of Forestry. People who live on forest land pay an annual assessment, and in its simplest terms, they pay half the cost of the forest fire protection for their property, and the general fund pays the other 50%. The $100,000 provision you're looking at is the enforcement mechanism, if you will, for the Act, and it applies only if the people have not done the work on the property and they have not certified, and if the fire starts on their property and spreads as a result of their not doing the work. So there's about four or five hoops that have to be jumped through before somebody potentially would have to pay a cost, and the cost could be $2 or it could be the $100,000, depending what resources are used to fight the fire. We don't anticipate collecting a whole lot of money out of this provision.
Okay. If I could follow up.
You bet.
Mr. Gibson, to what extent are the fires that are the main hazard to the homes in the urban forest interface do those fires originate on the homeowner's land, and to what extent are they naturally occurring or arising from other causes, and simply the location of their home then in effect draws resources, firefighting resources, to protect the home.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, hard question to answer, and it depends upon where in the state we're talking about, but as a general rule, one-third of the fires in the state originate from lightning, and two-thirds of the fires originate as a result of human activity of some type. Where there are more people and more homes, we have more fires, and there's a whole potpourri of reasons we have fires. The vast majority of our human-caused fires result from debris burning or other landowner-related activities. So in large measure, the landowners themselves are starting the fires. Now, we do certainly have fires, and the last couple summers have been some prime examples over in the Citrus area, for example, where we had lightning-caused fires that swept down out of the forest. And like Gil was talking about, there's a fuels problem there, and swept down towards the interface areas, and quite a response was needed to stop those fires.
Two-thirds are human-caused, and this is broadly, it sounds like, across the state. Do you have any data, or maybe even what might be an informed speculation, about to what extent are the fires in this urban-forest interface caused by activities of that property owner or a property owner who's also in the interface, if not on that specific property?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, the majority of fires in interface areas are started by the landowners themselves.
I could again.
Yeah, absolutely, Representative.
It sounds like there's a significant subsidy going on for the people who choose to live in those locations, because the what I heard a moment ago is that two-thirds of the fires are human-caused, mainly from those property owners themselves, and they're expected to pay for half of the cost of fire protection. That sounds like a subsidy going on. Am I right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kirsten, I'd rather not answer that question directly. I'm not the expert on the overall funding of the system. Those folks do pay a pretty good percentage of the cost. A typical interface landowner who owns a small parcel of, say, 1 acre will pay, in Eastern Oregon, will pay approximately, say, $1.25, but in addition to that, they have to pay a minimum assessment of another $17 or so, and if they have an improvement on the property, they have to pay a surcharge of $38. So they're paying a pretty good share of the maintenance of the system. If they're liable for a fire because they've done something they're not supposed to do, they burned without a permit, or they left the fire unattended, they become liable for the entire cost of the fire, and we send out hundreds of bills a year to people to recoup our firefighting costs.
Sorry, but entire cost up to $100,000, if I'm reading this language, or is this a new limit?
I'm mixing apples and oranges here a little bit. Under the Act, if they don't do Senate Bill 360 work and they're not negligent in the fire, if the fire starts by lightning, for example, they would be liable for potentially up to $100,000. If they burned in their backyard and were negligent, they have to pay the entire cost.
Okay, I see.
And
okay.
Would it be of interest to you to, you know, maybe have them work up something about the assessments, and, you know, so you have a little, you know, we get at some point later potentially a document that shows what the average homeowner pays into the system now?
Mr. Chair, it's not that I have a specific idea for how we ought to be trying to modify the bill. I'm trying to understand sort of the larger background and the kind of the picture that I'm taking away from it. This is that The people who live in the urban forest interface pay quite a bit because of the natural hazard of where they've chosen to live, but that quite a bit probably doesn't cover all the costs because it's just a high hazard place to live, and wildfire is in a climate that's seasonally quite dry is just one of the naturally occurring problems we have here. So I don't think I need more detail.
Okay. Representative Maurer, did you have a question?
No, my question would be, so two-thirds of the homes in the interface aren't burned every year. Correct? I would hope not. So, I mean, it's essentially, it's a risk. It's an insurance policy, and the risk is spread over a huge number of homes. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, President, yes.
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 Okay. So, I view it as an insurance policy.
Okay, I think then if there's no more questions for these gentlemen, we'll move on to the next interesting topic, which is coming from the realtors and Harlan Levy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, here to offer our support for this bill. However, we do have one concern that would be addressed with the Dash 1 amendment that is hopefully before you today. First, let me say that obviously we support this program, Senate Bill 360, which passed a decade ago. It's good public policy to ensure that homeowners take the steps necessary to protect their investment as well as to protect the state's forest resources. However, our one concern with this bill, as drafted, is found on page 7. If you look at lines 24 and 25, and the amendment would remove that particular clause. Our concern is the ambiguity that would create for a property transaction. We just don't know what that means. Inform the buyer of the minimum standards. Does that mean they have to orally inform them? Does that mean they have to provide something in writing? Do they need to go back and look for the copy of the minimum standards they might have received 5 years before and go through the files? We just don't know. I do want to put on the record that the rules that the Forestry Department has does require this, and we're okay with that administrative rule. It's also probably going to be considered a material fact to the transaction, which would need to be disclosed by the seller upon sale of the house as well. You do have various statutes on the books and other chapters of the ORS. We're just a little concerned that having it in here and having it be so ambiguous might lead to some problems with real estate transactions, with buyers saying they didn't receive the required notice and using that as grounds to seek rescission. We're just worried about that particular clause. So we would respectfully ask that this committee amend the bill with the Dash 1 amendment, and then we'd be happy to offer our full support for Senate Bill 99. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for Mr. Levy. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Levy, refresh me, if I ever knew, just what are the disclosure obligations? If I sell property to you, what am I obligated to disclose about it?
Chair Clem, Representative McPherson, you have to disclose all material facts. A material fact is defined as anything that affects the condition to or the title, the condition to the property or the title to the property. Being located within one of these interfaces, I would argue, is a condition of the property. I mean, you need to do certain things pursuant to this act. You need to remove the shrubs. You need to, I'm not familiar with the actual specifics of what are required of these landowners, but there are certain things they have to do to make sure that their property qualifies. So that is a condition of the property, and that would have to be disclosed at the sale. That is just the common law, and you do have a statute that specifically says certain things are not material facts. And the rest, if it's not listed and it is a condition of property, it is a material fact, and that's based on a series of cases that we have over 100, 200 years of case law in Oregon.
I have a follow-up question, but he may
first. You want
first.
To follow up
no,
on
you
that?
Go ahead.
Okay. I agree. Representative Dingfelder.
Harlan, the concern I have is if the landowner is liable for costs, then isn't it important that we make sure those are disclosed? And you know, that's what I'm struggling with here. I can understand that you not wanting to be responsible for if you're selling that house, but the flip side is that we don't want somebody buying a house and then all of a sudden finding out they're liable for paying the price tag and not knowing. I mean, that would be the flip side, you know, thinking about making sure we're protecting the consumer who is interested in purchasing these properties. So if you can help me maybe understand better how we can make sure that somebody doesn't buy a property and then find out that they're potentially responsible for paying the cost of fire, you know, that they make sure that they have that information.
Chair Clem, Representative Dean Felder, we'd be happy to work with the Department of Forestry on this provision and have some specific requirements. Right now, there's nothing there. It just says must inform, and that's very ambiguous. If there was something there that said, you know, they must inform them of a certain thing, they must provide them with a certain document, that's different. And we would also ask that there be something put in there that said that failure to do so would not cause the buyer to have grounds to rescind the contract. We're always worried about that as well. So we can work on that, and we do understand your concerns. Just the way that it's written now, it doesn't tell us what needs to happen, and it concerns us when an obligation is in statute, but it doesn't say how you fulfill that obligation for purposes of a real estate transaction.
So, and then I'm going to go to Representative McPherson, but one question might be for the agency is, do they have, sometimes the statute will give the broad thing, then a rule will say what the specific is, so we might get some feedback about whether there's already a rule that specifies this or it should be done in rule or statute, but I want to get back and let Representative McPherson do his follow-up.
Well, I was going to urge you the direction you're already headed, actually, is that I think removing the requirement entirely is undesirable, but I certainly take your point that it's pretty vaguely stated here, and if there could be a more kind of get a more defined nature of the obligation, and it's not our aim here to try to chill, you know, to throw cold water on a potential sale. It's to make sure that there's information, appropriate information in the buyer's hands about what the situation is that they're buying into when they take that property. And as long as they're informed and it's pretty clear, that meets our need, I think.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I just wanted to ask Mr. Levy, how do we designate if anybody's even on forest land urban interface? I've never seen that on a deed or title or overlay or... Is that what you're talking about, the ambiguous part?
Chair Clem, Representative Smith, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. That's a good question for the department. Where are the lines drawn? How do you know if you're in or if you're out?
So, in other words, how would you know to notify people if you sold the land if you don't even know if you're in it?
I could comment on that. At least I'm just familiarizing myself with the bill right here, kind of on the fly. But I see Section 8, page 5, lines 15 and following. The state forester may designate and classify forest land urban interface. So it looks to me like the forester then has authority under this bill to provide that designation, and so it only if such a designation had been made that this obligation would attach. Okay.
I think what I'm going to do so we can make sure we get on with the rest of our agenda is have you and the department work this out. We're just going to continue the public hearing, not go into a work session, and discuss what the current practice is and what would be, you know, disclosure statement. If that's what we want, then let's call it that, or whatever you end up you know, agreeing to, that we can take a look at a proposal. Any more questions on other topics related to? Okay, great. Thanks, Harlan.
Thank you.
Randy Simpson, our Oregon State Fire Marshal. What happens when you let me chair hearings? There's just, we get in all kinds of complicated sub-issues.
He's right. Issues.
Right, they are.
Yeah. That's why we have hearings.
That's right. Arnie chose today to leave. Right. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Clinton, members of the committee. Randy Simpson, Chief Deputy State Fire Marshal, Office of Oregon State Fire Marshal. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 99. As a wonderful partnership that we have with ODF through the years, we get to go out and visually see and assist with Senate Bill 360. And with this proposal, this is a win-win to us because it does help the homeowners and the agency have a timeline established when these projects that they initiate with Senate Bill 360 to establish them. It's been kind of vague in the past how long they needed to go. We see this as a very good win-win for the fire service, the agency, and our office. As you're aware, last year we got to see Senate Bill 360 basically in action, the Black Crater Fire Sisters. During that fire, firefighters from the state that were mobilized under the Conflagration Act and under the State Fire Marshal's Office Incident Management Teams reported on homes that were in subdivisions that had established 360 standards, reporting to us that they were defendable homes and they would survive. And during that fire, no homes were lost. And when that fire came out of the Federal Forest Service that was alluded to earlier, the ODF firefighters and our firefighters worked together to do a burnout operation with the wildland firefighters to put a stop to that fire encroaching on the homes, where we were able to mobilize our firefighters from the fire and send them back home a lot quicker once it came to the managed lands of ODF. So I'm pleased to be here in support of Senate Bill 99, and I hope that you'll join me in supporting this wonderful bill and continue the great process of Senate Bill 360.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Simpson? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And then I wanted to call one more witness, Jim Welsh, come up and share with us some thoughts since you were here during some of the work on some of these bills.
Chair Klim, committee members, Jim Welsh, and I'm speaking for the Oregon State Range today a little bit. They have policy around some of this, more so around what you do as a body here, and how it's taken at the local level. And I had a chance to be part of what Lane County was doing around the intent of Senate Bill 360 in February of 2006. And they established some requirements that just to let you know what happens when you do something here. And the intent of 360 is good, and I voted for it, certainly, in 97. But the intent was to do a tremendous amount of education and bring a lot of landowners retrospectively on board, you know, and they wanted the counties to do the same thing. But some counties, as you know, can take, get the bit in their teeth and run with something. And that's really what happened down in Lane County. And here's a few things that they saw that they had authority to include. They had their committee, the interface committee, but they applied 11 more zones, okay, that would have requirements within 360 requirements at the local level. And they would require that the road construction be certain of a certain type, a certain width, and you could not have a certain slope, an excessive slope, on that road. And those of us that live out in the forest interface and my particular property itself would not comply, you know, if we weren't already established there. If we want to build our place, we would not have a way into our property under those rules that the county wanted to establish, okay, because of the slope. All right, and if we are required to do this retroactively, then we have a lot, you know, down a half mile rock road, a lot of things to consider on cost, and for a lot of property owners off this this road. And we had over 200 people there at the hearing in February, very excited. I think it was just two or three of them that were, you know, approving of what the county was doing. The rest of them, and we had environmentalists, because they were very concerned about that defensible area, you know, 100 feet away, 50 feet, 100 feet away from their homes. They had wildlife areas. They had certain plants and everything that they didn't want to have to cut down. But under the rules established by the county that they were proposing, they would have to do that. And they would then have to plant certain fire-resistant plants instead. And I guarantee you, by the time, you know, that we heard from over half of these people on that night, There was very excited people about this. The county commissioners then, in a subsequent hearing, decided that they would follow the original intent of 360, and they would provide a brochure how to defend, you know, how to prepare your property. And my wife and I do that. We're under 360 in our forest interface. And so we keep, you know, a lot of that vegetation back. And so if a fire blows in, we can defend our home. And there's no doubt about it. The road isn't, because the other property owners around there, you know, we're looking at thousands of dollars to bring that road up to code so a fire truck can come down it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, basically our insurance is going to cover us if the fire gets to the house. We hope it doesn't, because we've taken some trees and things away. But the county also wanted to get into construction of your home under code requirements there, the type of siding, you know, type of eave construction, and type of roofing. You know, some of those things are very common sense, and you'd want to do that to protect your property. There's no doubt about it. But they were mandating this, okay? And that is one of those things at the local level that gets a lot of people excited. And then it's real easy for a county or other jurisdiction just to point and say, well, it's the state that required this. Right. And really, actually, in a 360, they did not. They didn't require that you do all of this. It's common sense, and to protect your property and others. Yeah. I certainly support the effort, and 99 is a good piece of legislation. But other things can happen once it's out of your hands, out of this building.
It sounds like, or at least proposed to be happen, then get shot down under the democratic process by 200 angry neighbors.
Sounds like our language.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You bet. Any questions for Jim? Great. Thank you for sharing how these things sometimes play out. Okay, that's all I've got on Senate Bill 99, so I'm going to close the public hearing, and we'll wait to hear back on the conversations regarding the disclosure. Okay, we're going to actually now open our work session on House Bill 2520.
Mr. Chair.
Do I do that? I don't know.
I move House Bill 2520 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, and I would make the motion that we put on the consent calendar.
We do that after we first approve the...
We can do it all as one.
Can? Okay.
As long as there's no
amendments. Okay. So Representative Smith moves House Bill 2520 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation, also on the consent calendar.
It's unanimous.
Any discussion? Okay. When do you do a conflict of interest if you own one of these things?
I don't think yet.
Do I have to? I'm trying to figure.
No.
We own one.
Before
so
the
I
vote. You want to do it before the vote.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no idea what the senator is, but I heard Representative Boquist made some comments when he was here that he's got several of them. I didn't know if that was his intention or not, but I'll just declare a potential just in case we do own one of these that would qualify and potentially could be out on the road with it now under this law. So those of the opinion, House Bill 2520 should be reported to the floor with a do-pass recommendation
placed on the
consent calendar. We'll vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Boquist
is excused.
Representative Flynn?
Aye.
Representative Nichtfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Chair Roman?
Excused. The motion and received the required majority is declared passed. And who would like to carry? Oh, no, we don't need a carrier because we're on the consent calendar. Great.
You want to say it's a carrier class and we'll be playing.
You can,
yeah. The bill, what's one House Bill 2520 is passed and will be placed on the consent calendar. Okay. So then we were going to open the public hearing possible work session on the Senate Bill 240. And would you like to give us a little rundown of this bill?
Certainly. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 240 extends the program that provides landowner preference tax to address damage caused by elk on privately owned land in Southern Oregon until June 30th, 2014. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so we've got Roy and Steve. Well, you're from the department, but why don't you recognize yourself still for the record?
I may lose my voice here, I think. I don't know when Steve talked, it was about a second, but good afternoon, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I think I'll let Steve Denny take care of the testimony today. Still suffering from a cold.
Yes, thank you, Chair Clem. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Denny. I'm the Southwest Regional Manager for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife out of the Roseburg area. The bill before you today, we offer these comments on it. The bill would extend a sunset on the Southwest Oregon Landowner Preference Pilot Program from June of 2008 to June 30th of 2014. For those of you that don't know, the Landowner Preference Program is a department program that basically guarantees landowners tags that they can provide to their family members and, in some cases, non-family members to hunt deer, elk, and antelope on their property. The Landowner Preference Program has two different portions, one an antlered portion of it and the other one a damage portion, and this particular bill addresses the damage part of it. The Southwest Oregon Pilot Program was created by House Bill 2521 in the 72nd Legislative Assembly, and basically began in July 1 of 2004. Because the bill sunsetted in 2008, we only had two full years of implementation to see if it was successful in reducing elk damage to private lands. And the reason we're asking for the extension is to give us a few more years to have the data necessary to see if it is effective. In 2001, we recognized an increasing damage problem caused by elk in Southwest Oregon to private lands, and we worked with our private landowners, Oregon State Police, and our hunters associations to try to come up with some modifications to the existing landowner preference program to see if we could be a little bit more user-friendly, a little more effective and efficient in dealing with those damage problems. And basically, the differences between our pilot program and the regular landowner preference damage portion of the program is basically this program addresses antlerless elk only because that is our biggest issue down in Southwest Oregon. It redefines wildlife damage. The current program defines wildlife damage as presently occurring. What we did was redefine it as a history of damage in the area presently occurring or in one of our elk de-emphasis areas where we really don't want to see elk increase. We eliminated the minimum acreage size because we did have some unique situations with vineyards and orchards and commercial crops smaller than 40 acres, which is the minimum under the original program. And if we could safely hunt there, we felt we wanted to address some of those smaller acreages. Tags are agreed to mutually between the landowner and our biologists. There's no more under the existing program. Tags are based on the amount of acreage that you use or that you have, and then the number of tags are allocated by that. We took that limit off in this pilot program, and basically you could have an unlimited number of tags, but in order to keep a limit on it, no more than five could be valid at any one time. So therefore, a landowner could have five tags. If they harvested two elk, we could go ahead and issue two more tags valid on that particular property. We asked that the landowners were required to keep track of the elk taken on the LOP tags, and then we established an advisory group to evaluate the program. We included a backgrounder for your information there that tells a little bit more detail about what this program does. But as I mentioned, we've been working with landowners and our sportsmen's groups for a number of years, since about 2001, and then worked with Senator Cruz on House Bill 2521 to see if we could implement these changes. It's been in place two full years, I say, just entering its third year of implementation, which ends in March. Things look very encouraging now. We haven't seen any reduction in damage, but the landowners are very pleased. It seems to reduce the length of time the damage is occurring and the intensity of the damage. The animals are getting learning that that's probably not the place they need to be when they enter those private lands. And On the first page of the backgrounder, I give you a list of the Southwest LLP Advisory Group. You can see from there we have people from throughout Southwest Oregon. This takes place on the five Southwest counties, Jackson, Josephine, Douglas, Coos, and Curry. And we have a combination of landowners, hunters, Oregon State Police, Oregon Hunters Association, all that we meet with on an annual basis to discuss the program, bring up any issues, because this really is a pilot program, and we did not know for sure whether all of these things would be workable or not, or whether they would cause problems. And so the second page of the backgrounder gives you a chart that tells the more specific the differences between the existing landowner preference and the pilot program. And then the last two pages of the backgrounder shows you a couple typical instances down in Southwest Oregon where we experience elk damage in these shoestring valleys or little pockets of agriculture. The first one is in Ash Valley, which is up the South Umpqua River. There's four landowners on that strip in the middle there. It's surrounded by Umpqua National Forest. And our goal is to make the elk leave the private lands and go up on the national forest lands where they aren't really causing a problem and they're a little more accessible to the hunters. The back page of it is an area over in the Coos Bay area outside of Myrtle Point, the Sitcom area. Again, there's four landowners surrounded by forest lands, including BLM and some private timber company grounds. And both of these areas are places where we've implemented the pilot program. Like I say, the landowners have been very thankful to get some relief from the elk damage. And then, like I say, at the same time, we feel that the benefit to hunters are twofold. One is that the elk spend more time on public accessible lands, which provides them something to hunt. But the second thing is that our landowners are telling us that if we have a means to deal with elk damage, that they'll be a little bit more tolerant of higher elk numbers, mm-hmm. as long as there's a program in place that can deal with the damage that they resolve. But like I say, we've only had it in place 2 years, about to finish our third, but we need some more time to evaluate it. And with that, I'd answer any questions.
I have the first one. Is this Sitcom damage area that you're talking about, is that the Tioga unit for elk hunting?
Chair Clem, yes it is.
Ooh.
You're familiar with
it. Yeah, well, that's where I hunt, so I'll be happy about that. Any other questions? All right, then. That's all we've got for you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there anything else?
We have one more.
Okay.
Ray, why don't you come join us on this one?
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. The same drill on this bill. I'm pinch hitting for Mike Dykesel, who's our protection director, who is not able to be here today, but he had prepared a written statement and asked me to submit it and to put on the record that we support Senate Bill 240. This is a significant animal damage issue for us in Southwest Oregon, and we think this is a potentially effective tool to deal with it, but it hasn't been in place long enough to know for sure. So that was the reason why the extension makes a lot of sense to us, and we support with the testimony heard from the department and Senate Bill 240.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Ray? Okay, thank you. Well, without objection, I think we'll open a work session on this bill and go ahead. And so we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 240.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 240 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves Senate, I don't need my script, Senate Bill 240 to due pass with a recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, let's ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Plum?
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Boatwood? Chair Klein, or Chair Oberlin, excuse me.
Motion, bill is approved. We'll go to the floor.
And I would think this could be on the consent calendar, too, but I will so move.
Okay. Yeah. Representative McPherson moves to place this bill on the consent calendar. Any objection?
Unless you'd like to
carry one.
Actually, I would enjoy it.
Objection noted. We're not going to move this to the consent calendar. The motion fails due to an objection.
It's withdrawn. Motion withdrawn.
Oh, it's withdrawn for the record. For the record. Representative Maurer will carry the bill. Anything else I have to say? Great. With that, we're going to close the work session and adjourn our House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources.
Well, I wasn't thinking about it. It's yours.
Thank you very much. So that's